top of the morning to you. It's great to see you. You all look great in green, and we all know it's not easy being green, but you're pulling it off. So welcome to MCC. And just, you know that song we just sang? One of the things I like about that song is we essentially sing that song from God's perspective, right? I mean, we're singing as if we're God in the song. And what I think is powerful about that is, I don't know if you think a lot about what you do here. When you enter into this room and we sing these songs together, often church becomes kind of this thing like up there, they're going to perform some songs and I'm going to come and do some stand up or something. And then we're going to send you guys out. And that's what church is. Actually, when we get together in a room like this, church, you guys are the choir. We're the choir. They're leading us and we're the choir. So if you walk out of here sometime thinking, you know, I just didn't get it today. Well, you weren't a good choir, right? We weren't a good choir, and this is what we're called to be. And so when we sing that song, the thing I just thought about this morning at the 9 o'clock service, when I was really thinking through those words we were singing, is that, you know, we're singing that song from God's perspective. It's almost like I'm singing it to you and you're singing it to me as a way of being reminded that no matter what we've done, no matter where we've been, no matter how bad we screwed up, no matter what's gone off the tracks, that God still loves us. He still pursues us, and that absolutely nothing we can do will ever change that. No, no amount of brokenness and pain and sin, no amount of doubt, no amount of questions, no amount of disbelief, nothing that we could possibly ever do can change the fact that we are loved, accepted, and pursued by the God who made us. And so this morning, as you were singing that, I felt as if God were saying it to me, and hopefully as you heard your brothers and sisters all around you singing that, you heard God saying that to you as well, that nothing you could ever do would change the love he has for you. And he will pursue us and pursue us and pursue. He will never stop chasing after us. He will find us. That's what he does. That's what God's about. He's about love and embrace. And so maybe you're here today and you've kind of felt maybe like God didn't feel that way about you. And hopefully when you heard those words today, you were reminded that the same God who speaks to us, the same God who comes to us in Jesus, is the same God who today says those words to you. Nothing you can do. We'll change that. So this morning, we are in the midst of Lent, and today and next week, we're going to be talking about deadly sins. Then we're going to take a week off on the 31st because it's some kind of holiday. It's Easter. And I've told people this, and I hope you understand what I mean by this. Easter, for a Christian, Easter is our Christmas. And here's what I mean about that. Like, our culture makes a really big deal about Christmas, but for Christians, like, Easter is the day. Easter is the day we find out the tomb is empty. And so I hope as we ramp up the next couple weeks, this week we're looking at lust, next week anger, and then we're going to take a break from deadly sins and we're going to celebrate resurrection. So you're the choir and we expect you to come red bulled up on Easter Sunday. Are you with me? Like, whatever you got to do, however much coffee you need to drink, whatever Red Bull concoction you need to come up with, like, we're going to blow the roof off the place, and we need your help to make that possible. So I occasionally get excited about Easter. I don't know if you knew this, but it's a big day. Today, though, we're going to talk about lust. And so I just want to give you this little kind of disclaimer before we get started. If you have, this is definitely going to be PG-13-ish. Okay. So, I mean, I don't have like a, you know, pictures or, but like, it's going to be PG-13-ish. So here's what I need you to do. If you have a child with you and you think, I really don't want them to be introduced to some of this stuff at church, I would rather like do that at home or, you know, let somebody else do it somewhere else. Then we have an incredible children's ministry and student ministry that are available right now. And I'm going to pray and you can feel free to slip out and take your kid, because we would not want to say something that you as a parent aren't ready for your kid to hear about a particular topic. So I just wanted to kind of throw that out there so that in the end, if you let them stay, you can't be mad at me because I told you ahead of time, right? So I'm going to pray and feel free to kind of get up and take them if you need to. Children's ministry, we'd love to have them. We have a great children's ministry. Our students are meeting right now, have a great student ministry, and they would love to see their faces as well. So let me offer up a word of prayer. And when I get done, if you're still seated in this room, I assume you're ready to go. If I open my eyes... This is going to be a long... Let's have a moment of silence. Yes. And so if I open my eyes and you're still here, which I hope you are, then we'll run with it. So let's have a word of prayer. God, grateful for the truths we've been singing about this morning. That you will find us. The psalmist said, if I make my home in the heavens, or if I descend to the depths, if I go to the grave, you will find us there. And we need to be reminded. Because we live in a world that tests our resolve and our trust in that again and again. Many of us today, specifically as we talk about issues of sexual desire and those sorts of things, I would imagine many of us in this room are carrying around some brokenness and some pain and some regret in that area. And it would be very easy to let that drive us away from you. Like the story of the first humans in Genesis talks about how when they sinned, they hid. And often when we go off track and we hide from you, we're hiding from the rescue that you want to bring, and the wholeness and healing you want to bring. So may what we talk about today, may it not be about guilt or shame, because that's unhelpful. But may what we talk about today be about liberation and freedom. May it be about a new start, a fresh perspective. May we maybe think about our sexuality and how we use it. May we think more deeply today. And may we think about what it means to be both faithful to you and to be a sexual being that you created us to be. We love you and we're grateful. And everybody said, amen. Now, you're all wearing green, but your face is about to get red because we're going to talk about lust. Now, I need to say first and foremost, lust isn't always about sex, okay? You can talk about lust for self-inflation and self-promotion, and we would call that what? Pride, which we've already talked about. You could talk about lust for stuff other people have, for their possessions or for their lives, and we would call that envy, and we've talked about that. You could lust for possessions or money would be what? Greed. We talked about that last week. You could have a lust for overindulgence, like you just never know when to push away and say enough's enough, and we'd call that what? Gluttony, or we could have a lust for like revenge. We'd call that maybe anger or wrath, which we're going to look at next week. So lust rears its ugly head in all sorts of ways. But since we're talking about all these other sorts of ways, today I want to focus specifically on what does lust have to do with sex and with our sexuality and with sexual desire. So I'm going to say the word sex a lot today, probably more than you've ever heard at church. And so then next week we're going to talk about anger, and your face may be red for other reasons next week, because anger often makes us turn red. So, but this week we're going to talk about lust and why it can be destructive. And so before we jump in, this is not going to be on the screen because I don't want you reading ahead. I want you to really listen to what we're reading here. So we're going to read because here's the thing. Often, when sex and Christianity get brought up in the same kind of statement, here's what always people think. People think, man, Christians are just a bunch of repressed prudes. I'm a Christian, and I think that, right? Like, Christians, we're just repressed prudes. We're afraid of our sexuality. We're afraid to say that we were made as sexual beings, that we have this component. So we're like really embarrassed about that and afraid of that. So we would never want people to talk about that because it makes us a little embarrassed. And so, yeah, Christians are kind of, and is the answer to that question is yes. Often Christians are a bunch of repressed prudes. But that's not our tradition. Right? That's not our tradition. Our tradition is a tradition that talks deeply about the beings, the sexual beings we were made to be, and how we're supposed to use that sexuality in a way that, in some ways, even in our sexuality, we honor God. Even in the way we use the sexual desire we've been given, in some way we honor the way God intended us to be. So, I want to read a passage from a book of the Bible. So this is in the Bible. It's called Song of Songs. How many of you ever read from Song of Songs? Like, nobody reads this book. It's because it's a little embarrassing. But I want to read this because I want you to see, in the Christian tradition, this is written from Jewish Hebrew tradition, but we claim this as followers of a Hebrew Jewish Savior. And so this is written in the Hebrew tradition. And people, scholars, talk about this in two ways. First, the Song of Songs is a song between two lovers. There's a he and a she, and occasionally there's some friends who chime in and say, yes, yes, your love is beautiful, whatnot. So there's this kind of, between this man and this woman, it's kind of a wedding song that they sing to one another about their love and how they feel about one another. But that's kind of on the surface. But when you dig deeper, scholars say, you know what this song's really about? Song of Songs is ultimately about God's intimate, passionate love for human beings. And when you read Song of Songs, it's like God is speaking to people, and God is desiring intimacy and connection with people. And this is a metaphor for something much, much larger. So I want to read something he said, then I want to read something she said, and then I want to just kind of, we're going to move on, we're going to look at some other passages, but I think I want you to see that it's possible to talk about this from our faith perspective in a way that we shouldn't be embarrassed about, in a way that really, I think our embarrassment over this issue is really kind of creating a lot of problems for our kids. Would you agree? Like the fact that we aren't willing to talk about what it means to be deeply spiritual and yet deeply sexual at the same time. It hurts our society, it hurts our kids. So we just want to talk about this. So Song of Songs 4, verse 1. Listen to this guy as I imagine he's singing this or something. How beautiful you are, my darling. Oh, how beautiful. Man, this guy, he's good, isn't he? He's good. Your eyes behind your veil are doves. Your hair is like a flock of goats. When this guy walks around, he walks to, like, in his head, he's hearing, you can't tell by the way I use my walk, I'm a woman. And this guy knows how to talk to women. Baby, your hair is like a flock of goats. If a guy said that to you, what would you think? I need to wash my hair more. It's like a flock of goats. Your hair is like a flock of goats descending from the hills of Gilead. Because we all know the flock of goats descending from Gilead are better than the flock of goats from other places. Your teeth are like a flock of sheep just shorn coming up from the washing. Each has its twin. Not one of them is alone. Your lips. That was about teeth. Right? Did I say something? What did I say? Is that about teeth? Okay. Because it's going to get better, so just hold on. What? Okay, I was afraid there was a slip of the tongue. Because when you read this publicly, you need to be very careful. Are you with me? Oh, your lips are like scarlet ribbon. Your mouth is lovely, which is where they got the, you sure do got a pretty mouth. That's where that came from. Your temples behind your veil are like the halves of pomegranate. Your neck is like the Tower of David. Which doesn't sound like a compliment. He just called her a giraffe. Like, but whatever works. Your neck is like the Tower of David, built with courses of stone. On it hang 1,000 shields, of them the shields of warrior. Your breasts are like 2 fawns, like twin fawns of a gazelle that browse among the lilies until the day breaks and the shadows flee. I will go to the mountain of myrrh and the hill of incense. All beautiful you are, my darling. There is no flaw in you. And all the sisters said, this dude is a smooth criminal. Would you agree? He knows how to operate. I mean, you just start right out of the gate, baby. Your hair is like a flock of goats. You've got some sheep in your mouth. You know, it's just like, oh, yes. Now, notice how he continues in verse 9. You have stolen my heart, my sister, my bride. You have stolen my heart with one glance of your eyes, with one jewel of your necklace. How delightful is your love, my sister, my bride. How much more pleasing is your love than wine, and the fragrance of your perfume more than any spice. Your lips drop sweetness as the honeycomb, my bride. Milk and honey are under your tongue. This dude is in love, and he knows how to express it. Right? We need Hallmark. Right? That says, you know, I met you, and that's cool, and I really love you. And this dude's like, your lips are like scarlet. Now, she responds back. And in her section, we're going to read in chapter 5, essentially, he has come to visit her late at night, and she's already gone to bed. And notice what happened. She says, I slept, but my heart was awake. How many of you know what that's like? You slept, but your heart, and it's kind of like, doo, 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 doo. And she loves this guy. Listen, my beloved is knocking. Open to me, my sister, my darling, my dove, my flawless one. My hair is drenched with dew, my hair with the dampness of the night. She says, I've taken off my robe, must I put it on again? I've washed my feet, must I soil them again? My beloved thrust his hand through the latch opening. My heart began to pound for him. I arose to open for my beloved, and my hands dripped with myrrh, my fingers with flowing myrrh on the hands of the bolt. I opened for my beloved, but my beloved had left. He was gone, and my heart sank at his departure. I looked for him, but did not find him. I called him, but he did not answer. I mean, do you know that feeling? When Carl and I had been married just over a year, we had to spend our first couple nights apart. And I made a sappy, sappy, sappy mix for both of us. And I had to go to Indiana. And like I cried all the way to Indiana. I just miss her. We talked on the phone. It's kind of like, oh, we'd never been apart. You know what I mean? And there's this is oh, I want to be with this person. And he's gone. I can't find him. My heart. She was probably like, thrown a party, like, he's gone. But for me, it was very, very traumatic. And there's this sense in Song of Songs, like, oh, this love is so strong. We don't want to be apart. We want to be together. And then notice what happens in Song of Songs 8. Now, this is going to be 8 verse 4. This also occurs in 3 verse 5. Notice what this is the woman speaking, and she's speaking to kind of her friends, her attendants who serve her. Because most people think King Solomon, this was written about King Solomon and one of his many, many wives. Notice what she says. Daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you, do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires. Now, this phrase, until it so desires, actually in Hebrew, more literally translated, it means until it is ready. She says, do not arouse or awaken love until it's ready, until the right time, until the right situation. Don't jump the gun when it comes to love. Now, the word love that's used here, it's the Hebrew word ahava. I'd love to hear you guys say this with me, right? Ahava. And it means essentially spousal love, love between two spouses. But it also can be translated as desire. Do not awaken desire until it's ready. Which seems to indicate that there's a time when to awaken desire would be wrong, correct? Because there's a time when desire isn't ready. There's a time when you, maybe we should put it this way, there's a time when you aren't ready for it. And so often when Christians talk about sex, the one message we get out is don't do it. Right? And we just leave that across the board. Nobody should think about it, and nobody should talk about it. But actually what this says is that there's an appropriate time, an appropriate place, an appropriate context when desire, sexual desire, it's beautiful and it's good and it's right. But there's also a time and a place and a context, not just when desire's not ready for you, but when you're not ready for it. Because I was a teenager once. And some of you say you were. And here's the truth. Many of us probably had this thought when we were teenagers, when we were way too young, we're way in over our heads, is, you know, if we just had sex, it would make everything better. We would be so much closer. And here's the reality of sex. Sex is Pandora's box. And when sex in a relationship, even the best possible relationship, sex can become complicated and it can become difficult. And what she says here to these other, her attendants who are watching, sex is so sacred and so beautiful and so complex and so mysterious that you need to keep it in its proper place. You need to keep it where it needs to be, because if you take it outside of this context and it gets all muddy and difficult and it brings all sorts of brokenness and confusion, and you have to keep it in the right spot. So let's say this next. Talking about sexual desire. Sexual desire is a God-given thing. It is a blessing. When God, in Genesis, the creation stories in Genesis, God creates a male and female, and he blesses them and says, be fruitful and multiply, which is a way of saying, go have sex, and I'll give you my blessing. Right? This is how God made them to be. Actually, the word that is used to describe the relationship between the man and the woman in Genesis, the man and the woman were one flesh. It's the word echad. That word is later used in Deuteronomy to describe God. God is echad. It means, we translate it one, but it means a unity brought about from many other things. And so, God, this is good. This is right. Sexual desire is a God-given blessing, a good thing. But sexual desire, when it's unrestrained and unchecked, it can actually take a blessing and turn it into a curse, which is true about any blessing, right? I mean, you can be blessed with a really good meal. And you can take that really good meal. I remember one specific time I've done this a lot, I'm sure, in my life. But I remember one specific time we were visiting my grandmother in Tennessee, and she made pot roast. And pot roast is one of the quickest ways to get into my heart. She made pot roast, and I hadn't had pot roast in a while. And this was years ago. Carla and I hadn't been married very long. And I ate like 8 pieces of pot roast. 8. And they were not small pieces. And I remember going home thinking, God, if you let me live, I will never eat pot roast again. Right? Because too much of a good thing is not necessarily good for you. So there's an appropriate way to enjoy blessing. There's an appropriate way to enjoy God's goodness. And yet you can take that goodness and blessing and turn it into a curse. So I put it like this. The problem isn't that the slide isn't changing. The problem isn't sexual desire. Right? Because there are some faiths, some religions, some people who say, here's the problem, that all desire is bad. We need to get rid of desire, and we just need to focus on, like, praying all the time. No desire, desire is bad. Any desire, any joy, we need to get rid of. The problem isn't sexual desire. God made us that way. The problem is when we take that and we improperly direct it. The problem is improperly directed desire. It's awakening love before it's ready or before you're ready. It's taking love outside of this context, this beautiful context it was created to be. And Will Willimon, Methodist bishop, puts it like this. Desire is a good God-given thing. Desire misdirected and misused leads to sin. Now, we've talked about sin. At the first week of this series, we talked about sin. And we said, you know, those categories we've had for sin, like sin bad, sin bad, sin bad. Sin is, yes, we can say that. But why is sin bad? Sin is wrong because God made the world a certain way to have a certain wholeness and peace and blessing. The word for that is shalom, everything in its appropriate relationship with everything else. And sin is anything that disrupts that, that disrupts harmony, that vandalizes God's good world. And here's what he says, desire is a good thing. But you see this clearly in the Genesis 3 creation story, fall story, where they see that the fruit of the tree that they've been commanded not to eat from is good for food and pleasing to the eye, and they desire it, and so they eat it. Desire is a God-given thing. Desiring the wrong thing, it can actually kill you. Or desiring too much of a good thing can actually kill you. So he says here, desire is a good thing, but when you misdirect it and send it in the wrong way, it can actually harm you instead of bringing you delight and joy. Jeff Cook, in his book on the seven deadly sins, he says this. In our culture, brokenness birthed from misguided sexual pursuits is widespread. The value placed on sexual indulgence leads many to destroy their families, squander their savings, and even give up on life itself. I mean, we probably all know stories, heartbreaking stories of people who allowed lust, this is just clearly what it is, allowed misplaced sexual desire to harm their lives, to hurt their families, to make really bad, bad decisions. Next. It is certainly healthy to want sex. There are even profound truths that can be discovered through sex. As we already talked about, the word for one, which is describes what these first two people do. They become one. It's a word that also describes God. There are big truths that can be learned through sex, even about God. However, when our desire for sex takes us over, when our appetites demand whatever they wish without commitment or care, our sexual longings step beyond their natural role. The sexual passions make wonderful servants, but terrible masters. And when given authority, their rule is untamed. We call such rule by our primal urges lust. Lust is handing control of my body and mind over to illicit cravings. I feel like this is a really good time to offer up a confession. Everybody's wondering what it is. This time of year, I really struggle. And I struggle because every time I go to the grocery store, just by the checkout lines, there are these little delights called Cadbury cream eggs. Thank you. I can say anything about Jesus, no response. Cadbury eggs, woo! Yes. Now, here's the problem with Cadbury eggs. I love them. I love them. They're bringing them out earlier. I think I was eating one around Christmas this last year. You know, it's like they're bringing them out earlier and earlier. I love Cadbury cream eggs. And actually now, they don't just make them in a 4-pack. Now, you can get the bonus 5th egg for free pack, which to me just makes economical sense, right? You're getting one free. And so we try not to keep them in our house because we'll put them in this big pantry we have. We'll put them in there. And every time I walk by the pantry, I hear them whispering my name. And the whole thing, it's not just the egg, it's the whole experience. It's peeling back the foil wrapper and looking at that delicious egg that you're holding in your hand. That looks like it's just a hollow, but when you bite into it, it's filled with this delicious stuff. And it kind of looks like a real egg, and you get a little grossed out, but then you get past it really quick. And I could literally buy a 5-pack in one day and be sitting on my couch in a sugar coma that afternoon because I've just downed all 5 Cadbury eggs. Right? And so we try not to keep them at home. I try to actually keep them away from me because when they are there, I'm just going to eat them and I'm trying to do better. My dad's had some heart trouble, so I'm just trying to be preemptive. And so I'm trying not to eat things I don't need. But when they're in that pantry, gosh, it's so difficult. And here's what he says about lust. Lust is anytime we allow our cravings to dictate who we are and what we do. And that's true across the board. Whatever the kind of lust may be, if it is a lust for a Cadbury cream egg, and it dictates what you do and who you are, then it becomes an issue. He goes on to say this. At its core, lust wars against the community we ought to share with one another. Distorting duties, confusing friendships, breaking up marriages, betraying children, creating false intimacy, turning us away from the pleasure of another person toward mere self-gratification. Because that's what lust is, right? Lust, at its core, is just like pride, and it's just like envy, and it's just like greed. Lust drives us into isolation. I mean, think about where does lust occur? It occurs in the realm of fantasy. It's in the heart. It's in the mind. It begins in the realm of fantasy. And so it seems harmless. I mean, it's just a thought. It's just in my brain. It's not like I'm doing anything. It's not like I'm acting on it. But lust begins in the mind. And what's interesting is that we were created for community. And essentially, what ideally in the scriptures, when you talk about a marriage, for example, in scriptures, the ideal is, I mean, there's even this verse in Ephesians that says, husband, love your wives as Christ loved the church and died for her. So like the first question a woman ought to ask a guy on like the first date is like, okay, are you willing to die for me? Because if you're not, then this can't go any further. Right? This is like the gravity of this relationship in the scripture is that there should be a mutual self-giving between two people in a marriage like this. That both spouses should be pouring themselves into the other person, thinking completely of the other person's needs, completely of the other person's well-being. And lust removes that whole messy thing called a relationship out of it. And relationships, like, are you with me? Are relationships messy? I think so. At 9 o'clock, I said, now let's everybody be honest. Has there not been a time since you were married to the person you're married to? Has there not been a time you thought, oh dear God, what have I done? And everybody in there was going, nope. Nope. It's great too, because like most weeks we'll go, how many of y'all struggle with, let's do this. How many of y'all struggle with pride? How many of you guys struggle with pride? We'll be honest about that. How many of you struggle with greed? Yep. Mm-hmm. Envy? Struggle with envy. You look at other people's stuff in their life and you think, man, why can't I have that? And then you say, how many of y'all struggle with lust? Every hand goes down. And every guy in the room is like, baby, I've never had an impure thought, ever. Not even before I met you. I am pure as the driven snow. Right? Because it's almost like there's this embarrassment. Why? Because lust exists in the realm of fantasy and secrecy. That's what gives lust its power, is it's done in secret. It's in the mind. It's in the heart. It's in a fantasy world. And in your fantasy world, when you're lusting about a person, they don't matter. You don't care who they are. You don't care what their life's been like. You don't care what their story is. We dehumanize people in our brains and in our hearts, and we make them objects that solely exist to please us. Right? That's what happens with lust. It is never a giving and receiving between two people. Lust always exists in the mind, and it's always about getting it your way, having what you want, the person serving you, caring about you, but you never have to put yourself on the line and give anything away yourself. It essentially is all about you. Lust drives us into isolation. And if you were here when we talked about pride and you're here when we talked about greed, you know we've talked about isolation before, and isolation is always synonymous with hell. Isolation is when you're completely cut off from every significant relationship that matters. Isolation is when you're driven inward. And it is the exact opposite of how we were created to live, which is why the scriptures spill a lot of ink dealing with lust, because lust is one of those things like pride, like greed, like envy in many cases. It drives us away from the relationships we were meant to be a part of, and it makes life all about us, and the sole reason we exist is not to serve and give and love others. The sole reason we exist then is to receive from others. And so Jesus addresses this in his Sermon on the Mount. I mean, like, for Jesus to address this in kind of one of his most profound teachings, it kind of shows the weight Jesus gives to this. So notice in Matthew 5, if you have a Bible, we're going to have it behind me as well. Matthew 5, Jesus says this in verse 27. You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. Now, where is that said in the Bible? There are these big things we all argue about putting up places. Ten Commandments, right? Jesus says, you've heard it said, and immediately, Exodus 20, Ten Commandments, you shall not commit adultery. And I think most of us would probably go, yeah, that's right. We shouldn't do that. That's not the right thing to do. Jesus says, you've heard it said, you should not commit adultery. But I tell you, so Jesus is going to take what we've always heard. He's going to turn it on its ear. But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Now, I have questions Because this seems a little ridiculous. Does it seem ridiculous to anybody else that, because it's just in your heart, it's just in your mind, why does it matter? First of all, why does Jesus pick on the guys here? Right? He doesn't say guy or gal. Like, he's very specific. If any of you commits adultery with or lust after a woman, you've committed adultery in your heart. So I think Jesus understands how guys are maybe wired a bit. And then notice what he says next. If your right eye causes you to stumble, gouge it out and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to stumble, cut it off, throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. I mean, it seems a little bit like Jesus is blowing this a wee bit out of proportion. I mean, first he's talking about just if you even lust in your mind, it counts as adultery. Jesus actually says the thought does count when it comes to lust. Like if you're lusting, you're actually committing adultery. And then he says, actually, it would be better for you to lose body parts than to go to hell over lust. Does anybody else think that seems a little ridiculous? A bit of a stretch. Now, I have people, friends, who sometimes say that we should take the whole Bible literally. And so I want to show you what it would look like to take this literally. I need somebody who's lusted recently. I want to invite you to come up on stage, and I've got a hacksaw. I'm not kidding. We're going to take this passage literally. We're going to see how painful this is. No, there are certain parts of the Bible we don't take literally. We realize Jesus is maybe an extreme, but we realize what he's saying is like, listen, this is serious. Lust is serious. Lust has the power to really mess things up. And you should take it so seriously that you would rather lose part of your body that is essential than to actually end up. He actually talks about hell. Hell. How many of you have ever wondered what hell looks like? Anybody ever wondered? Now, what's interesting is our conception of hell actually doesn't come from the Bible as much as it comes from Dante's Inferno. Remember reading this in school, and there's like these nine rings of hell, and Dante kind of, and we, you know, dude with a pitchfork and tail and horns and a weird goatee pointed, you know, that's kind of what we walk around with. But that's not actually, if you take what Jesus says here and you actually try to put it in his context, that's not what he's talking about. In Jesus' day, when he uses the word hell, it's the Greek word Gehenna. And actually, the word Gehenna refers not just to an idea, but for Jesus' listeners, the word Gehenna would actually have referred to an actual, concrete, real, historical place that they would have known. I want to show you a picture of hell. That's hell, as it is today. Now, in Jesus' day, this place was known as the Valley of Hinnom, or originally it was known as the Valley of the Sons of Hinnom. And so this place in Jesus' day, when I said this at 9 o'clock, I made the same mistake. I said in Jesus' day, it was located on the southern slopes of Jerusalem, which I think it still is today, unless they moved it at some point. So it's located to the south of Jerusalem. And this place has a very storied, painful history. This place, the Valley of Hinnom, was a place where in the time of the Old Testament kings, a king named Ahaz and his son Manasseh went to the Valley of Hinnom and they offered up a sacrifice to another god, a god named Molech, a god named Baal. And they offered up a sacrifice to these other gods. And what they sacrificed are their firstborn children because these gods demanded child sacrifice. And so they would take their firstborn children and they would set them on fire as an offering to the god Molech and the god Baal, because they were in some ways, they believed that if they offered and appeased these gods, that these gods would be good to them in a way that their god wasn't. And so this place, and beyond, this place has history after history of terrible, despicable, awful, hellish things happening in this place. And so by Jesus' day, they had turned it into the town dump. And so in Gehenna, it's where you would bring your trash, where you would bring your refuse. Often, if somebody was executed by the Romans, you would actually take their bodies and you would just throw them in Gehenna. And in Gehenna, because it's a town dump and those things fill up quite quickly, guess what they did? They set the trash on fire. And so always in Gehenna, there would be fire smoldering and burning because you have to get rid of old trash and old refuse and old waste to make room for new waste. And so when Jesus says to these first people listening to him, now this took on cosmic dimensions later, and people would talk about, is it possible that after this life there's like a Gehenna for people who've wasted this life? And those are all sorts of those things we could talk about. But when Jesus says this in his day, his listeners thought of that. Smoldering trash heap. It's a place where waste was disposed of. And for them, when Jesus says, it would be better to cut off your hand than go into Gehenna, I mean, they would have understood exactly what he's talking about. they would have connected all the dots. See, for them, Gehenna wasn't just a place you would go after you die. For them, they begin to realize Gehenna is actually can be used as a metaphor for how we live as well. We may have to face Gehenna later, but what about facing Gehenna now? And Jesus says, when you give in to lust constantly, when you're unrestrained, it's like lust causes you to catch, it causes your soul to catch on fire. And it burns it all to ashes. I cannot tell you the number of times I've sat across from somebody who is recounting to me a story of how what began in the mind actually took on flesh and blood and actually became something that happened. And now they're trying to figure out how to sort through it with their spouse, their kids, their family. It gets messy. And so Jesus begins, it would be better for you now and later to end up in Gehenna than it would be. I mean, it'd be better for you to lose an arm than it would be to do that, right? Because you can end up in Gehenna now and you can end up in Gehenna then. And it would be better for you to lose an eye or lose a hand than to let lust control your life in a way that's going to destroy it. Do you think Jesus takes lust seriously? Does Jesus, like, it would literally, I think Jesus means this in some ways. Like, if you can't control lust, it would be better for you to lose your hands and your eye. It would be better for you to lose all that than to keep going through this cycle of brokenness. Now, N.T. Wright, he says this about this passage. Now, I think he's right. He says, don't suppose that Jesus means you must never feel the impulse of lust. Because that's the hard part, right? That's the difficult part. How do you stop from ever thinking, man, he's pretty. You don't say that about guys, do you? He's pretty. That's a pretty man. But how do you like, oh, she's attractive. He's attractive. They're nice. Like, how can you stop that? He says, it's not about that initial impulse of lust when you look at someone and see that they're attractive. That would be impossible, and it's not the case with what these words mean. What he commands us to avoid is the gaze and the lustful imagination that follow the initial impulse. You can't stop yourself from thinking, man, that person's attractive. Right? It's not like you think, oh, they're attractive, where's the hacksaw? You know what I mean? Like, that's not how this works. But the problem is what begins, and this is why Jesus says, if you do it in your mind, then it's just the same as actually acting on the desire in your life. Because what begins in the mind, what begins in the heart, if left unchecked, will work its way into reality. I don't think most people who have risked everything and risked their lives and risked their family and risked everything, I don't think they've risked it because they woke up one day and thought, you know, this seems like a great day to go and have an affair. I just think I'm going to go for it. I think it begins with a thought life that is left unchecked. It begins when you descend into a fantasy world and you're isolated from real commitment and real relationship and nothing is being asked of you, but you're receiving everything. And you begin to believe that, man, if this is how it's going to be, the grass would be greener. Nothing is demanded of me. This is easy. This is the easiest relationship I've ever been in, right? And that's the problem. It's not reality. It's not real. And Jesus says, it would be better for you to cut off your hands than to begin to believe that what's in your fantasy world is real and you risk everything to have it. And what you find when you get it is that it has betrayed you. Actually, what's interesting about the Bible is you sometimes struggle to find stories about certain things in the Bible, but when you're talking about lust, it's like open your Bible, close your eyes, and point, right? There's plenty of stuff about lust in the Bible, which tells you something about the human condition. But I want to read you one story and just make a couple thoughts, and then we're going to be done, and I'm going to stop talking about lust, and I'm not going to say sex anymore up here for a long time, okay? But this story in 2 Samuel 13 is so powerful. Because I think this story really, everything we've talked about, lust beginning in the mind, it working its way out, if you don't keep yourself in check, if you don't really wrestle with what you're thinking, it can really ruin your life. Notice what happens here. This is about David's kids, a few of David's kids. In the course of time, 2 Samuel 13:1, in the course of time, Amnon, son of David, fell in love with Tamar, the beautiful sister of Absalom, son of David. Is anybody noticing anything funny about this story right off the bat? Amnon is in love with who? His sister. At 9 o'clock, I said, I think this story takes place where I'm from in Eastern Kentucky. And everybody's like, oh, like, I can say that. I'm from there. Right? So Amnon is in love with his sister Tamar. Amnon became so obsessed. Where does this begin for him? In his mind, you can say in his heart, it begins. He's so obsessed with his sister Tamar that he made himself ill. She was a virgin, and it seemed impossible for him to do anything to her. Does that phrase make you as sick as it does me? it was impossible for him to do anything to her. Is this about her? Is this about a relationship with her? Is this about her hopes and dreams for the future? Is this about who she is and her story and honoring the image of God found in her? No, she's an object. She's an object in his fantasy world, disconnected from reality, disconnected from real relationship, disconnected from all that muddy mess that we call life. She's in his brain. It seemed impossible for him to do anything to her. Now, Amnon had an advisor named Jonadab, son of Shimei, and he had a brother named Shake, and so they were... You know, when you're talking about this ad nauseum for like 40 minutes, you have to find a way to break it up. You know what I mean? Because it's just like, okay. He had a son of Shimei, David's brother. Jonadab was a very shrewd man. And he asked Amnon, why do you, the king's son, I mean, you're the king's son, you can have whatever you want. Why do you look so haggard morning after morning? Won't you tell me? Amnon said to him, I'm in love with Tamar, my brother Absalom's sister. Now, if you're his advisor, what do you say here? Dude, creepy. Right, dude, this is not, okay, back up. But notice what he says. Okay, go to bed. I mean, he just has this plan on tap, ready to go. Go to bed. Pretend to be ill. Jonadab said, when your father comes to see you, say to him, I would like my sister Tamar to come and give me something to eat. Let her prepare the food in my sight so I may watch her and then eat it from her hand. So Amnon lay down and pretended to be ill. When the king came to see him, Amnon said to him, I would like my sister Tamar to come and make some special bread in my sight so I may eat from her hand. If you're David, where is your odd, weird request kind of radar on this one? Aren't you going, dude, why can't I just send a servant? Why do you need her? But David sent word to Tamar at the palace, go to the house of your brother Amnon and prepare some food for him. So Tamar went to the house of her brother Amnon, who was lying down. She took some dough, kneaded it, made some bread in his sight, and baked it. Then she took the pan and served him the bread, but he refused to eat it. Send everyone out of here, Amnon said. So she left him. So everyone left him. Then Amnon said to Tamar, bring the food here into my bedroom so I may eat from your hand. Now, if you're watching this as a movie, this is like, you know, this is where it's going to go wrong. And notice what happens next. Then Amnon said to Tamar, bring the food in here to my bedroom so I may eat from your hand. And Tamar took the bread she had prepared and brought it to her brother Amnon in his bedroom. But when she took it to him to eat, he grabbed her and said, come to bed with me, my sister. No, my brother, she said to him, don't force me. Such a thing should not be done in Israel. Don't do this wicked thing. What about me? Had this ever gone through his head? What about her? What about the fallout for her? In this culture, which could be very harsh toward women anyway at times, like, she would bear the brunt of this. She would bear the brunt of the shame. Her life, in many ways, would be train wrecked if he does this. What about me? Where could I get rid of my disgrace? And what about you? You would be like one of the wicked fools in Israel. Please speak to the king. He will not keep me from being married to you. But he refused to listen to her, and since he was stronger than she, he raped her. Then Amnon hated her with intense hatred. In fact, he hated her more than he had loved her. Amnon said to her, get up and get out. No, she said to him, sending me away would be a greater wrong than what you have already done to me. But he refused to listen to her. He called his personal servant and said, get this woman out of my sight and bolt the door after her. Now, this story began where? In his mind, in his heart, in his fantasy world. And he goes through and he does everything. His fantasy in many ways gets fulfilled. He has sex with his sister Tamar, which he's been wanting to in his fantasy world. This is it. And what happens to him after it's over? It says he hated her more than he had loved her. Did he love her? She was an object. She was something to be used. She wasn't a person. Her shame, her guilt, or her family, everything about her would change. And he doesn't care. Now, what I find interesting is if you follow the story of David from here on out. David does nothing about this when he's confronted with it, by the way. He does nothing. And so Absalom goes and kills Amnon, and it starts a civil war between David and his son Absalom, who ends up getting killed. And eventually David has a son from a relationship he shouldn't have been in named Solomon, and he becomes king. And eventually, because of Solomon's son, the whole kingdom splits, and they all end up going into exile. And many people trace it back to David's infidelity with Bathsheba, and David not responding the way David should have responded when somebody comes and says, one of your sons raped one of your daughters, and you need to do something. And it all began in Amnon's head, in his heart, in the secret world nobody knew anything about. And it spilled over into real life, and it wrecked a kingdom. And when he had had what he had fantasized about, what does he say? He hates her. It's not what he thought. Next, lust. I think we need to be told the truth about lust. It's deceptive. It makes all these promises it can't deliver on. And you begin, if I could just be with her, if I could just leave my life and be with him, if I could just bail out and be with that other person, everything would be great. It wouldn't be, because you are dealing with a fantasy version of them that exists in your head, and it's not real. And what you'll find is when you jump the fence looking for greener grass, the grass isn't always green. It actually usually isn't. There are all sorts of more complications, all sorts of more problems than you could ever possibly have imagined. The grass isn't greener. Lust is deceptive. It's built on a lie that says all you need to do is escape your life and find another one. Whether it's in your head and heart or whether you actually do it, it's all you need to do is escape your life and find another one. And it ends with brokenness. It ends with pain. Rarely have I ever sat down with somebody who says, I had an affair, and then go, and it was the best decision I ever made. You know, I don't really meet people who go, if I could go back and do that all over again, I'd have done it sooner. No. No. It always centers on brokenness, regret, pain. And what you think is really just about you, because in your fantasy world it is, actually has all sorts of fault lines that spread out from it to affect kids and communities and families. And it affects everybody around you. And what you think you're making just is a selfish decision about you is actually a decision you're making for a lot more people than you possibly could imagine. And so Jesus says, it actually, instead of, like, can we use a great phrase from Barney Fife when he talked about this? You just need to nip it in the bud. Right? You just need to deal with it. You need to deal with it before it becomes an action. Because everything you and I do begins in our hearts. And it was in there long before we acted. So Jesus says, start before you ever are actually in the situation where you might act on this fantasy. Start way before then and decide what you're going to do if you're ever put in a... You need to decide now how you'll act then. Because if you don't, you're going to allow lust to take over and you're going to make some regrettable, devastating choices. So what we've tried to do each week is talk about, what do you do? Like last week we talked about greed, and one of the things was you just need to start, I mean, there maybe you need to give some stuff away, right? And that's how do you counteract the power of lust? And I would say just two things real quick. First, you need to have clear boundaries. Especially if you're here and you're married to somebody. You need to have really clear boundaries of what is okay and what is not okay. And those boundaries need to be in bold, and they need to be deeply engraved in the sand around you. It needs to be really, really firm boundaries. You need to know what's not okay and what is okay, right? And so you have to decide with your spouse, what do I need to do to protect my heart? Because in protecting my heart, I'm protecting our marriage. And in protecting our marriage, I'm protecting our kids, and I'm protecting our family. I'm protecting our community. I'm protecting our church. I mean, this is a big, big, big deal. What are appropriate boundaries? I mean, like, for example, I do not counsel women in closed rooms with nobody else around. It just does not happen, right? But it's just not... I don't take cross-country trips with people of the opposite sex. I just don't do it. As a matter of fact, I don't even take cross-country trips with my wife, because I don't take cross-country trips that often. But, you know, you have to know what is okay. What is my spouse comfortable with? What do I do to make sure? Because, listen, the sign of a downfall is when somebody says, I realize that happened to Amnon. I realize that happened to King David. And I realize Jesus takes it seriously. But that will never happen to me because I'm too strong. I love my spouse too much. I love my kids too much. I love my community too much. I just have too much love for God in my heart to ever struggle with that. Are the words of the fool before they fall? Right? And so beginning with, it will never happen to me, is a sure sign that you aren't ready. So what are those boundaries that you've set in place? Have you talked about this? What are those boundaries? What is okay? How are you trying to protect the sacred commitment you have made to another person? And not just to that other person, but to your family, to the broader. Like, how are you protecting that sacred relationship? And then two, what about accountability? Because you can't control when you think, man, that person was attractive. But you can control what happens next. So is there somebody you can go to and say, I saw somebody the other day and I really thought they were attractive and I probably thought they were too attractive and I need to get this out before it starts playing like a loop over and over and over. Now, Amnon did not have a good accountability guy, right? Amnon goes, man, I really kind of into my sister. And he's like, here's the plan. You don't want that person in your life. You want somebody who's going to be honest and compassionate. Somebody who you know is not going to, like, when you tell them, man, I'm really struggling with lust, they're like, okay, could you spell that because I'm trying to tweet this over here? You don't want that person. You want somebody who they're a vault. And when you tell them, man, I'm really struggling with this, they can say, well, I'm glad you told me because I'm going to call you every day and I'm going to ask what your thoughts have been like. And I'm going to ask how your heart is and I'm going to ask where you're going with this because I care about you and I care about your family way too much to let you go unchecked on this. And you need a friend who'll get in your business and ask you really, really, really uncomfortable questions. And by the way, they're not just going to be uncomfortable for you. They're uncomfortable for your friend too. The times that I've been asked uncomfortable questions and had to ask uncomfortable questions, those are awkward for everybody. But it's worth it because you're protecting something. You're stopping something before it starts. Do you have somebody in your life that you're actually being held accountable by? Your marriage matters to them. Your relationships matter to them. And so they're going to ask you the difficult, uncomfortable, painful, awkward questions that make you really deal with what you're thinking and what you're feeling and who you're becoming. I know when you hear this, there's like this impulse, the 21st century impulse is to say, but what about my freedom? I need my freedom. I need to be free to think about what I want and do what I want. I need to be free. See, the problem is we have bought into the illusion that that's what freedom really is. I love how Rob Bell puts this. He says, freedom is not having everything we crave. It's being able to go without the things we crave and being okay with it. Freedom is not being able to give in to every whim you have. Freedom is being able to look at those things that tempt you and entice you and say, I've already said yes to someone else and something else, so I say no to that. It's being able to walk by a Cadbury egg last night at the grocery store and say, you do not own me. And everybody in the store looks at you like, he's lost his mind. And maybe he has, but he did not buy a Cadbury cream egg. Right? You decide before you go in the store. I don't care where they put the display. I'm not going to do it. You got to have principles, people. Right? And you decide ahead of time, I want to be free. And freedom does not, because well, often what we think freedom is leads to more and more slavery, enslavement, bondage, and pain. And true freedom is not being owned by anything. Except love and a commitment that you honor and protect. I mean, as a pastor, I stand right, usually up there, with people on one of the biggest days of their lives. And I ask him and I ask her, you know, you guys serious about this? You're going to do this? And we do some vows. And I really don't think anybody ever goes, and, you know, at some point, I'm probably going to be unfaithful to you and it's probably going to ruin our lives. But let's go ahead and do this anyway. When you don't have boundaries, when you leave your heart unchecked, you open the door. When you don't have somebody who's in your business asking you uncomfortable questions, you leave open the door to go down roads you never were meant to go and roads you never really dreamed you would go. Freedom isn't giving in, isn't being able to have everything you crave. Freedom is being able to look at all the things you crave, but because of a deep conviction and commitment to something else, something you've already said yes to, you look at those things and you say, absolutely. I made the decision before I ever walked in the store. I will not leave here with a Cadbury. I made the decision before he ever made the advance. I've already said yes over here. I can't say yes anywhere else. And this for Jesus, this is serious business. This is lose your hand, lose your eye, do whatever it takes to avoid this sort of business. So let's pray. God, I pray for those of us in this room who, because of maybe decisions and mistakes we've made in the past, we're carrying around all sorts of guilt and shame in this area. And for us, our sexuality, our sexual desires are not a gift, but they've really become a curse. They've become a source of pain. I pray for those who have been hurt by others through a misuse of sexual desire. Pray for healing and hope and comfort. And God, we read such beautiful words in the Song of Songs about, in its appropriate context, how beautiful sexuality is and what a gift it is. And then when we read in other contexts, when we take things into the fantasy realm and we obsess, it leads to trouble. So God, make us people of great convictions in this area. Not prudes, not people who repress, but may we handle our sexuality with the great care it deserves, because it is sacred. This desire that we're born with is sacred, and it's holy, and we should handle it with great care. May we find great freedom, not through saying yes to everything, but by saying yes to some things that are more important and saying no to others. May we find freedom from the past, from regret. And for many of us, may today be the first step on a new journey toward wholeness in this area. You're the God who never gives up, the God who never backs down, the God who never runs away, but the God who runs toward. And we pray that as you run toward us today, we will stop in our tracks and let you embrace us with the love and the wholeness and the forgiveness that you desire for each and every one of us. We love you. We thank you. We pray this in Jesus' name. And everybody said, let's stand together. If you'd like to talk or pray about any of the stuff we've been talking about today, last week, this series, whatever you've got going on, if you just need a sounding board,